Hear ye, hear ye. Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Before we begin, I have a couple of announcements. The first one is there's going to be a fire alarm at 11 o'clock. You don't have to leave. It's just a drill. I will jump because I always do, even though I know it's coming, so don't let that bother you. And if you jump too, well, I'll understand. So 11 o'clock, if we're still talking, you just have to wait for it to shut down, and then we'll continue from wherever we are. It may be that, you know, it won't go off when someone's speaking, but you never know. So I tell you in advance. Also this morning, my notes tell me we have students from Lancaster High School and Franklin Elementary School. If they are here, would they please stand? Look at that. Very nice. Well, you may be seated. We enjoy having the students come and visit. They are part of a program we do in coordination with the State Bar called Court with Class. So they've heard a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us today. Students, if you can stay after the second argument, so we have another argument that supposedly begins at 10:45, but that sometimes doesn't quite occur. In any case, when we conclude the second argument, if you can stay, I will come out and chat with you a little bit to try to explain a little bit how cases get to the Supreme Court, where they've been before, what reasons there are for us accepting some cases and not other cases. We won't talk about the substance of the case that we're about to hear, but there are a lot of interesting things about the court, and then I'll answer some of your questions. So if you can come back, please do, and anybody else that wants to join us, everyone is welcome. So with those brief announcements, I'll call our first case. Mitchells versus Lyons. Are you prepared to proceed?
I am.
Please do.
Good morning.
Morning.
My name is Ryan Steffes. I'm here today representing appellant Casey Michaels and appellant Keaton Lyons. I thank the court for agreeing to hear this case. I believe it presents important constitutional question, namely, when does the state's power to order fit parents to cede care and control of their child to a grandparent or another third party run into a constitutional barrier? And, of course, did the visitation order entered in this particular case impermissibly go beyond that constitutional barrier? I think all the parties agree that an important piece of understanding that question and ultimately answering it is the United States Supreme Court's decision in Troxell versus Granville. I think it's particularly helpful to identify what questions were answered in that case and to identify the one big question that was left unanswered. When you piece together all of the various decisions in that case, you come to realize that 8 of the 9 justices agreed that fit parents have a fundamental liberty interest in the care, custody, and upbringing of their children, and that the 14th Amendment of the Federal Constitution protects that interest from state interference. So we're not here today asking this court to plow new furrows in the field of substantive due process. The liberty interest at issue in this particular case is well established. I think Troxell removes any doubt about its existence.
Counsel, you also cite to the Wisconsin Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, but there isn't a lot of analysis in the briefing in that respect. My question for you, we have a Declaration of Rights. All people are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Can you tell me if there is any case law or history regarding the meaning of liberty in this context of familial relations?
I believe there is, and I believe what this court has done in the past is interpret that clause consistent with the federal equivalent found in the 14th Amendment, so that the Wisconsin Constitution provides equivalent substantive due process rights under the provision Your Honor just quoted.
I think it might be something different than substantive due process, though, because it's actually an embodiment of the Declaration of Independence of the country, kind of something unique in our state constitution.
I think it is, and it's obviously a very fundamental principle of law, given its place in the Constitution. Section 2 in that article is a prohibition against slavery. So this is a very fundamental interest. And the language provides that all people are born free and have certain inherent rights. And I think the reference to those certain inherent rights is comparable to the 14th Amendment language.
But, counsel, the 14th Amendment addresses process, right? Its text addresses process.
Well, that is one view of the amendment, and I think Justice Scalia would agree with that.
Well, let's start with the text. It addresses process, right? It says that these rights, life, liberty, property, can't be deprived without due process. It's not saying you can't deprive those rights. You can't deprive them without due process. Yeah? Just starting with the text, that's what it says, yeah?
Sure.
Okay.
That I think there's no dispute as to what the text says, but there's been a longstanding dispute as to what it means.
Yeah. So why do we have to bother with any of that? Article 1, Section 1 of our Constitution doesn't say anything about process. It goes straight to substance, right?
I think it does, yes.
Okay. So why do we have to bother with what the 14th Amendment says or means about substantive due process or procedural due process? Why don't we just rely on the Wisconsin Constitution?
Well, I don't particularly care which provision the court relies on. My concern is that if the court concludes that one provides a greater protection than the other, that my clients get the benefit of that provision. I think that historically they've been interpreted as being equivalent, and that's why we cite both. But whether we prevail under one and lose under another, or prevail under both.
So didn't we answer the question here in our case in Re Meister just 2 years ago? We said whenever someone brings a visitation petition, as dealing with 40.43 sub 1 as opposed to sub 3, but we said whether the petitioner is a grandparent, great-grandparent, step-parent, or other person, Troxell requires the deciding court give special weight to a fit parent's opinions, right? So we found that it was not unconstitutional. We conclude that the legislature's decision to allow that does not unconstitutionally infringe on parents' constitutional rights, because any best interest determination must give special weight to a fit parent's decisions regarding the child's best interest, right?
There's three things that I would say in response to that. First, I think the court's holding is actually limited to the notion that the Constitution doesn't require that the petitioner have a parent-like relationship with the child, which is a little different than what we're contending the Constitution requires. But even more importantly, there's two issues that weren't analyzed. They weren't raised, they weren't analyzed, they weren't considered in Meister, or for that matter in the earlier Court of Appeals decisions. Roger D.H. and Nicholas L. The first of those being, is the grandparent visitation statute subject to strict scrutiny because it infringes on a fundamental liberty interest? I don't think any Wisconsin appellate court has weighed in on that issue. This court certainly didn't in Meister. Through no
so
fault
do,
of the court.
Do we need to overrule what we said in Meister to agree with you?
I don't think you do.
So how can it be that under 0.43 sub 3, we would say that it's not constitutional, but it is constitutional under sub 1, when our reasoning would be virtually the same, but reaching opposite conclusions?
I think the court simply needs to say that this issue wasn't raised or considered in Meister, and the holding of Meister can be limited to the very particular question at issue, which is, did the Constitution require that the petitioner have a parent-like relationship with the child? And I'll note that that was actually really a secondary issue in the case. The primary issue was one of statutory interpretation.
Right. And we dealt with that, right? We said not so much on that. But then we said, additionally, we conclude. And then comes the constitutional conclusion. Yeah? So how is it that we could consistently with Meister say, no, we were right in Meister when we said there's no violation of the parent's constitutional rights because the court has to give special weight. But here it's unconstitutional, even if you give special weight?
I certainly agree that the court's decision in this case needs to address Meister. I don't think it needs to go so far as to overrule it. I think that a better characterization might be to expand on it or to clarify it rather than to overrule it. And the other issue that wasn't considered or analyzed in Meister that has been raised here is whether the Roger D.H. presumption, or quote-unquote presumption, that was read into the statute by the Court of Appeals, as it's been subsequently applied, does that presumption really give special weight to the parent's decision, or does it just restate the best interest of the child standard in a way that maybe at first glance seems to give special interest, but but as a practical matter, when it's applied, really doesn't give special weight?
Counsel, speaking of weight, would you be satisfied with us saying, okay, let's give the weight we should give or the burden that we should place, I'll use that phrase, is clear, satisfactory, and convincing. And that will take care of it, and you should be happy then and have nothing further to request. Would that end your quest here?
I think that would get the statute much closer to being constitutional.
Okay. You're also asking us to really read in harm here, aren't you?
I think that's right, and that's not a standard that we've just pulled out of the air or that other sister courts in other states have pulled out of the air. The reason that standard comes into play is because ultimately you look to what's the state's compelling interest, and that is protecting a child from harm.
What's the wording of the harm inquiry that you want us to embrace?
I think the court simply needs to read into the statute an element that goes to the petitioner's burden of proof, which says they have to prove that the parent's decision to not grant the visitation sought is causing harm to the child. And I think that still leaves room for case-by-case determination, but it gets away from the unconstitutional best interest of the child standard.
For instance, if I may just
please,
one comment. Thank you. I look at the certification, and it phrases it this way, you know, and words are really important. And so it says, a showing of harm to the child if the parent's wishes are upheld. Is that the way you want us to phrase the harm inquiry? It has been phrased several different ways. I want to know how you want us to phrase it. It seems as though harm to the child isn't sufficiently instructive.
I think the phrasing, which I believe comes from the Court of Appeals certification, is sufficient. I think that would accurately describe a standard that would pass constitutional muster.
Counselor, what we're really looking at, given the past case law, is a statute that now has a gloss on it, where there is a presumption that the parents' decisions, if they're fit parents, and there's no question about that here, carries the day unless the presumption is rebutted, correct? And so what we're here tussling about is what is the test that this court should apply and require other courts to apply to overcome that presumption, correct?
Yeah, I think
and in this case, I think the circuit court applied the presumption, but then the court instead of applying either harm or clear and convincing evidence, simply said, in my discretion, I'm going to order visitation for the grandmother, correct?
That's exactly right.
So the court really didn't add either harm or clear and convincing evidence. It just used the old standard for visitation among, for example, among parents who are separating or whatever, and then the test is discretionary, correct?
I think that's exactly right.
Okay, so our focus should be on what is needed from this court to clearly tell the courts that deal with these problems on a regular basis. Is it clear and convincing evidence that has to be shown, and is it harm? Now, I know you want harm. When I look at that, I think, how much harm? What kind of harm? Mental harm? Physical harm? It's a pretty amorphous standard that I don't think we've used in a way that has sharp edges. Can you give me an example of our using harm as a standard for a court to apply that does have sharp edges?
I can't think of one off the top of my head, no. But the one thing I would add is that I think when you compare the best interest of the child standard to the harm standard, the one that is actually more subjective and more elusive to apply is the best interests of the child standard. My view of the harm standard is that it puts the court, the circuit court, in a position that's roughly analogous to the position the court finds itself in when it conducts a certiorari review. It's not there to look over the decision maker's shoulder and say, oh, I would have done it this way, or I think it would have been better if you did this. The court's role is to see whether the decision falls within the bounds of reasonableness. And if it does, that's the end of the inquiry. And I think the harm standard is in some ways analogous to that, because what you're asking the circuit court to do is not to second-guess the parent's decision, but to say, is this a decision a reasonable parent could have reached? Of course, if it harms the child, I think it's fair to say it is not. And that triggers the compelling interest that constitutionally allows the state.
Counsel,
are we now going to have doctors come in and testify that the child has emotional harm because there is a separation from a grandmom or a grandfather who they were close to? Are we going to have medical people come in and discuss this with a psychologist? I mean, what are the sources for determining when there is harm?
I think there could be such expert testimony. I wouldn't say that it would be required to prove harm. And I think, you know, the harm standard isn't saying that petitioner has to have a parent-like relationship with the child.
That's not where we are on this
right.
case.
I understand that, but the point I'm trying to make is that one of Ms. Kelsey's criticisms of the harm standard is that it takes these cases out of a case-by-case determination that they contend is so important in family court, because every family's problems are different than every other family's.
Yeah.
And there's certainly truth to that. But this standard also gives case-by-case discretion. It simply sets a higher bar. So in one case, a grandparent may prove harm by showing that they had a parent-like relationship with the child and visitation was arbitrarily cut off. But perhaps in another case, the parent can meet that, or the grandparent can meet that burden with some lesser showing. There's still room for the circuit court to analyze the case-by-case facts and say, is this decision harming the child? And I understand this court's maybe saying that leaves too much discretion with the circuit court. But under the current scheme, the circuit court has even more discretion.
Well, I don't know if under the current scheme that's, at least under the current reported cases, nobody's gotten there yet to say, what do you need to rebut the presumption, right? I mean, that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah, I think that's the question that hopefully this court will answer. In this
case. Counsel, thank you. In answering Justice Anne Walsh Bradley's question of what you're asking from us, you said that clear and convincing would get us closer. Are you arguing to us that this statute is unconstitutional unless we read in harm?
That is our position, yes, although I acknowledge that Other courts have taken the view that a clear and convincing evidence burden of proof is sufficient to protect the liberty interest at stake.
Why isn't it sufficient?
I think the harm standard is the appropriate one because I believe strict scrutiny applies. And if it does, the first question then is, what is the state's compelling interest?
Right.
And I think the only compelling interest is the prevention of harm to the child.
Isn't it possible, though, counsel, that we could agree that we've already decided that under the same reasoning in Meissner that the statute is constitutional, but perhaps it's being unconstitutionally applied to your clients?
Well, and I think
that's
a
case-by-case determination, and that's what Troxell said. They said, we're not going to strike down the statute. We're not going to do that because these cases are too individualized. But they said it was unconstitutionally applied.
And we have made, I believe, an as-applied challenge in this case. I'm not saying there aren't circumstances, because there are circumstances where a grandparent can show harm. And under the current statute, of course, they'd prevail, even though they don't have to meet that higher standard. I don't think that's an unconstitutional application.
As I recall, Meister did not apply strict scrutiny. Is my recollection correct?
The question was simply never considered in Meister.
Right. Mm-hmm.
One point I'd like to make as it relates to strict scrutiny, you know, the threshold question as to whether strict scrutiny should apply is whether the visitation statute infringes on a fundamental liberty interest. And there's a quote from Troxell that I think speaks to that indirectly. The court there said, the extension of statutory rights in this area to persons other than a child's parents, however, comes with an obvious cost. For example, the state's recognition of an independent third-party interest in a child can place a substantial burden on the traditional parent-child relationship. And I think my clients would attest to that, and I think they did at the trial in this case. It's very difficult for a parent that we all agree is fit, to explain to a child why you have to go away for a week when the parent doesn't believe there's a good reason and actually believes that going away is contrary to your best interest. That damages the parent-child relationship. It erodes trust. It can leave the parent feeling guilty or inadequate. So I think it's very difficult for the other side here to argue that this visitation statute doesn't infringe on a fundamental liberty interest, particularly when it gives the circuit court what I consider very broad powers.
So, counsel, how come your argument isn't simply that when you have a circumstance in which two fit parents both agree that the grandparents should not visit, that ends the inquiry, right? And that any statute that tries to countermand the parents' decision on that, so long as they are fit and are in agreement, is a violation, right? And therefore unconstitutional as applied to them when there are two fit parents who agree.
Correct.
Why is that not the end of your argument? Why do you go on about harm
that is a reasonable way to resolve this case, to essentially find that both parents have their substantive due process rights, and when they're in agreement and those interests are aligned, they simply cannot be overcome.
Do you have to say substantive due process?
I can say fundamental liberty interest.
That might be better.
But in either case,
I don't see the difference. But.
Are you happy?
I'm much happier now.
But in either case, I think that is a fair conclusion, and I think that's a correct conclusion. The reason that that's maybe not explicitly put forth is that's not a path that I've seen other courts follow. And perhaps that's simply because the facts of this case are quite rare. It's not the typical visitation case because there's not a deceased or absent parent. You have two fit parents, both in agreement.
And are you making the argument then that this is going to come up potentially in other situations that aren't as clear as these facts and that the court should set some guidance to lower courts as to what that standard is going forward?
It certainly will. That's a very fair point. Because, again, this is the rare circumstance. I think if the court looks at the amicus brief filed by the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, the court would see how parents and judges and guardian ad litems struggle with this statute on a day-to-day basis, and how, because of how it's been interpreted, it's very subjective and it's very unpredictable as to what the end result is going to be. And that causes great problems, and problems that disproportionately affect lower income or pro se parents. So I do think it's important. This is an issue of statewide importance, that circuit courts and guardian ad litems and parents require guidance on from this court.
Precisely, tell me what guidance you would give them.
I think the correct constitutional interpretation in this case is to say that strict scrutiny applies.
Strict scrutiny applies to what?
To the grandparent visitation statute, because its application in cases such as this one infringes on a fundamental liberty interest. And then go to the next question, which is, does the state have a compelling interest, and is the statute narrowly tailored? And I think the compelling interest question is answered by this court's prior jurisprudence. This court has held that protecting children from harm is a compelling state interest, and I think everyone agrees that it is. I'm not aware of a case from this court where the court found that something else, something less than that, was compelling enough to justify state intervention in this historically very sensitive area.
So let's get to the narrowly tailored part of it.
Well, not surprisingly, I don't find the statute to be narrowly tailored at all. If you read it in concert with subsection 1 of the same statute, it applies to couples who are married, couples who are divorced, and couples who are never married, which covers, I think, everybody. Unlike similar statutes in other states, it doesn't require a parent-like relationship. It doesn't require a total denial of visitation, as this case evidences.
Counsel, before we strike down a statute, aren't we required to give it a constitutional construction? And if it's possible to give it a gloss from cases such as Troxell, aren't we required to do that and then to apply it in a constitutional fashion rather than striking it down as a whole?
Yes, and I'm not asking the court to strike the statute down as a whole. I think the court simply needs to take the gloss that was applied in Roger D.H. and expand on it and say that the presumption in favor of the fit parent can only be overcome by a showing that the parent's decision is or will cause harm to the child. Now, I understand there's the intermediate position, too, to say that it can be overcome by clear and convincing evidence. I see my light is on.
You can finish your answer.
But we obviously, for the reasons I've stated, feel that the harm standard is the one that really protects the fundamental liberty interests at stake.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Mandel. I'm here representing Jill Kelsey.
Make sure you speak up, counsel. Yeah, you might have to move the microphone. This is a terrible room to hear in for whatever reason.
Hopefully that's better.
It is. Thank you.
The circuit court here carefully followed Wisconsin law in adjudicating the petition for visitation. It began with a presumption in favor of the parents. It appointed a guardian ad litem who conducted a full investigation and then recommended, based on the results of that investigation, that the visitation petition be granted. It heard and weighed all of the evidence that was presented, and it ultimately granted limited visitation. Only at that point did the parents assert that settled principles of Wisconsin law violate the Constitution. Their objection should be denied as untimely and incorrect. This case, as the court was just discussing with Mr. Steffes, really involves two distinct doctrines. First, there's a question about the constitutionality of the statute. That question was resolved in the Meister case, where this court held that the gloss provided by Roger D.H. was correct and sufficient, and that the special weight that the Supreme Court outlined in the Troxell decision by that plurality is provided by a presumption in favor of the parents.
Counsel, in the Troxell decision, Justice Scalia, in dissent, said, in my view, a right of parents to direct the upbringing of their children is among the unalienable rights with which the Declaration of Independence proclaims all men are endowed by their Creator. Article 1, Section 1 of our state constitution embodies the Declaration of Independence. Could you address that portion of the Constitution which protects the inherent rights of liberty of the people of Wisconsin?
Your Honor, I would agree with Mr. Steffes' statement that this court has repeatedly held across the years that the Wisconsin due process guarantee and that section of the Wisconsin Constitution is coextensive with the protections guaranteed by the United States Constitution.
Counsel,
there's nothing about process in that clause, Counsel.
I hear you, Your Honor. It is my reading of this court's precedents that that clause has been understood to be interpreted as coextensive with the due process clause of the 14th Amendment.
And is that supposed to incorporate the substantive aspect of the 14th Amendment's due process jurisprudence?
I believe it does, Your Honor.
All right. So what? Just so I understand how we're supposed to consider this. So you're saying that our Constitution, which we say is to be interpreted coextensively with the 14th Amendment, we say even though our Constitution says nothing about due process and the 14th Amendment says nothing about protecting substantive rights, we are to impose a misreading or, a generous, non-textual reading of the 14th Amendment onto our constitutional provision to say that that's a procedural protection, but then go back to the 14th Amendment to get the substantive aspect put into a provision that already provides substantive protection. Why would we do that?
Well, Your Honor, I think I would suggest that we could do it much more simply.
Yeah, tell me how.
To say, because, as you pointed out earlier, that the 14th Amendment talks about process and doesn't talk about substance, what we might say is that we're not perverting or distorting the reading of the Wisconsin Constitution, we are simply accepting that the United States courts have already distorted the meaning of the due process clause.
So the United States courts...
They have taken those fundamental concepts that Justice Bradley read from the Wisconsin Constitution and read them into the United States Constitution
Justice
where
Rebecca
they don't appear.
Justice Rebecca Bradley, right?
There's yes.
Oh, there is
All right.
a difference, isn't there?
So let's just set aside the 14th Amendment for a moment. And let's just look at our Constitution. Without any glosses or distortions or anything like that. And it protects liberty interests, yeah? Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And we have long recognized that parenting is amongst the most important and fundamental of liberty interests, yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So what does it take for the state to be able to interfere with a parent's decision on how to raise their child? What does the state have to show?
Well, Your Honor, just as this court has long recognized that parenting is a fundamental liberty, so has the United States Supreme Court. And in this court's recognitions of that, they have repeatedly been based and cited to recognitions from the United States Supreme Court. So I think the answer to your question really is to look back at the Troxell plurality. What does it take? What is constitutionally mandated to protect that liberty? Well, a special weight in favor of the parents.
Right. Might I suggest that the Troxell plurality is a plurality because of that very thing? That it just says, well, we just give special weight. It's not a question of whether the state may intrude on what two fit parents decide for their children. We just give special weight. Maybe that's why there was not a majority in Troxell.
That may well be, Your Honor, but then I would say that we turn to this court's decision in Meister, where a majority of this court, six justices of this court, came together and agreed that the Troxell plurality was the correct way to approach this question under Wisconsin law.
And were we addressing a circumstance in which two fit parents agreed that the grandparents should not visit?
Well, Your Honor, we didn't address that specific factual scenario.
Okay. Doesn't that make a difference?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest it doesn't make a constitutional difference. It makes a policy difference. There are lots of things that have been raised in the briefing and discussed here already this morning, and several others we could discuss, that are reasonable policy arguments about when visitation should be allowed or not. But they're not constitutionally mandated, I would suggest.
Well, let me suggest a possible constitutional distinction. So let's say we have two parents, they're not married, and they are both fit, but they disagree on whether grandma should be able to visit the grandchild, right? So what do you do with that circumstance? Well, I think, you know, if you have a circumstance like that, perhaps the state it's appropriate for the state to step in as a referee between the parents. But that's between the parents, yeah? It's not subverting both parents' decision. Isn't that constitutionally different?
I don't think it necessarily is, Your Honor, and I would suggest that when Mr. Steffes said earlier that harm is the only possible state interest here, that that's not accurate. I would direct the court to the Opichka decision, which talks about the state's interest in providing continuity for children in non-intact families.
Is that a compelling state interest?
By precedent in this state, it is.
So, counsel, when we talk about this presumption, does it really have any teeth right now? I mean, wouldn't it need something at least this clear and convincing burden of proof, or maybe the harm read in, to really have some kind of teeth?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, and let me explain why. The presumption's not meaningless. It applies in the parent's favor. It starts the proceeding off with them prevailing. It requires evidence.
What does it require? That's the question. Right?
It requires evidence to be provided and adduced by the petitioner that is sufficient to overcome that presumption. That means it can't all just be equal. If a grandparent comes in and says, well, I really want visitation because the child enjoys activity X and they can only do that with me, and the parents come in and say, no, the child's time is better spent on activity Y, the grandparent's not going to win in that circumstance, because the presumption is the tiebreaker when we have equality. And to talk about heightening the burden, Your Honor, one of the grave concerns of doing that is that visitation here, right, we're not talking about custody, we're not talking about placement, we're talking about visitation, which is a fairly smaller, a substantially smaller, really, infringement or curtailment.
This judge said that the grandparent could basically take this child anywhere for 1 week, and the parents don't have any say at all. You think that's not a substantial intrusion into two fit parents' decision-making over their own child?
Well, Your Honor, this judge gave specific reasons for that decision, required that there be telephone contact with the parents every day. And if the court were to say that that decision was somehow problematic, I don't think, again, that that's a constitutional issue. I think that might be a discretion issue.
What are the limits that the Constitution in the state of Wisconsin places on the legislature with respect to intruding on two fit parents' decision-making over their minor child?
Again, Your Honor, I find those limits in the plurality in Troxell as refracted and adopted in this court's decisions in Roger D.H., which was expressly adopted and affirmed by this court in Meister. What I was trying to say to Justice Dallet, and I think is helpful here, is that if we raise the standard, we should look at the termination standard, the termination of parental rights, which is a massively different in kind intrusion than any kind of visitation. And if we were to raise the standard to clear and convincing, this court would be applying a heavier burden to the best interests finding for visitation than it applies to the best interest finding for termination. And that seems to me to be disproportionate and really shocking. My point, again, is not that there isn't room to disagree about what the right approach to visitation is. My point is simply that the constitutional minimum that is set, that was outlined in Troxell and was set by Wisconsin courts in Roger D.H., Nicholas L., and Meister is satisfied here. Is there room to argue as a policy matter that it should be, that the visitation statutes should be tightened up? Certainly there's space to have that argument. I just don't think that that's an argument for this court.
Why,
Sorry, Justice Bradley.
No,
I was just going to say the constitutional minimum is a floor, and here the Wisconsin statute meets it.
I look at an opinion written by an esteemed jurist out of Utah, Christine Durham, and she takes this case, the same kind of case that we have here, and she says, but we need a little bit more. We need to elevate the standard to clear, satisfactory, and convincing. The opinion goes on to say, look, there are some problems with the statute, but we leave that to the legislature, and that enhancing the burden of the special weight, the burden of showing what the special weight is, satisfies the strict scrutiny analysis. I'm not sure she said that verbatim at the end, but satisfies the challenge in that case.
Sure. I'd like to set strict scrutiny aside for a moment because you took it out of that quote, and we do not agree that strict scrutiny applies here. But going back to clear and convincing, we would be talking about, I understand the desire to add a little bit more, but again, we're talking about a constitutional minimum, and to add a little bit more would mean that the inquiry on best interests here is heavier than the burden that the state needs to show in terms of best interest to terminate permanently and irrevocably a parental right. It seems when visitation of a few hours a month and 1 week in the summer, right? And visitation is flexible, so we could be talking about visitation that's much less than that too. But when we're talking about visitation, to say that the burden is equivalent to or greater than the burden for termination of parental rights seems to me to be disproportionate. And I think this court has recognized that. In the Evelyn CR case in 2001, this court discussed termination in terms that I think are really helpful, saying the permanency of termination orders works a unique kind of deprivation in contrast to matters that are modifiable at the party's will or based on changed circumstances. Termination adjudications involve the awesome authority of the state to destroy permanently all legal recognition of a parental
counsel, but you never get to the best interests of the child in the TPR unless you found grounds to hold the parent unfit to be a parent. So that's not where we are here. We have two fit parents, and everyone has agreed to that. So I guess I don't get the analogy with the TPR statute.
Well, Your Honor, there is a distinction there, and I agree with that. But what I would say is that the TPR analysis is a two-step one, right? We start with the fitness issue, and then we move to best interests. Similarly, in 743 sub 3 that we're talking about here, the legislature has set out several preconditions that have to be satisfied before best interests can apply. Notably, though, the parents are not asking for a clear and convincing standard for those preconditions, which would be more parallel.
Well, I think that's a secondary consideration for the parents because they see harm as a harder burden to meet on behalf of the grandparents. I get that argument.
Well, I think...
But they're asking for something. They're asking for something, right?
Understood, Your Honor. And I haven't even really discussed harm because, to me, as is set forth in our brief, harm is a broad rule that will decide most of the cases in a very crude manner that is going to be both over-inclusive and under-inclusive at some places. And there are lots of areas of law where we think that such rules are appropriate.
Well, and what's wrong with clear and convincing? We use it in a lot of places. It's a standard that the court is used to using. Last night I was looking at the standards again, and I tried to pull up clear and convincing. Evans, I got 10,000 Wisconsin cases where that standard has been used. So obviously something the court knows how to evaluate. How about that?
It is, Your Honor, but it's also something that the legislature knows how to say. Chapter 767 has five places in it where the legislature has expressly required clear and convincing. Two of those places appear in 767.43, the very statute we're talking about here. The legislature hasn't done so, and the legislature revisited these statutes.
I know, counsel, but if you have a variety of people that think the statute, on its plain words, may be constitutional, and I think lining it up with Troxell and eliminating the presumption could get you there very quickly. then if we are to construe the statute in a constitutional way, don't we have to deal with how the presumption can or cannot be overcome? It's rebuttable. Don't we have to set a standard?
Well, Your Honor, if I may, I have two answers to that.
Okay.
First is that we don't need to set a new standard because Wisconsin law sets a standard. Presumptions are rebuttable under 90301 and this court's case law about that. The fact that this court did not belabor that point and provide an entire treatise on presumptions in deciding Meister does not mean that that is not all incorporated there. Mm-hmm. And with respect to clear and convincing, my answer is to go back and say there's a constitutional minimum. The statute meets the constitutional minimum, as Wisconsin courts have held and this court reaffirmed in Meister. If clear and convincing certainly could be a reasonable standard, but it's not constitutionally required, and therefore it's a question for the legislature, which clearly knows how to do this and has done it elsewhere in the statute.
Okay.
Counsel,
thank
I'd like
you.
To turn you back. I'm sorry, were you finished? I'd like to turn you back to the compelling state interest that this is supposed to be furthering. You identified continuity of relationship between the grandparent and the grandchild. Whose right is that vindicating?
Well, Your Honor, the compelling state interest that I identified from Opichka is continuity for the child,
okay.
Not of that particular relationship, but just continuity in the child's life. I do think, though, that you touch on an important point, which is raised in the amicus brief here by the Cato Institute, which is that if we look solely at the parents' rights, we are not properly adjudicating the entire field of what's relevant here, because it is reasonable to think that the child has rights, and it is possible that others have rights as well. That hasn't been as fully developed in the law,
well,
but
it's
yet another reason to be extremely cautious and wary about setting a broad rule that favors parents' rights and privileges them to the extent that no one else's rights are considered. Really
right.
All.
So I think you're right that this is a very this idea of the children having rights as against their parents, because essentially that's what you're saying here, right?
Well, Your Honor, again, I think that the children's rights, I don't know if I would say against. I don't think that we force the children to take sides.
Well,
you
say that's the compelling state interest here, is for the child to be able to assert rights against their parents. Because you have two parents that are saying to the child, no, you're not going to go see grandma. And if what you're saying is correct, that the compelling state interest is that the child has the right to say, yeah, I want to go see grandma, and mom and dad, you're not going to stand in my way, and I'll get a court to say so.
Well, again, Your Honor, the way that the statute is set up is it's not the child that files the petition.
Well, so the statute's got to pursue an interest, right? And if the interest is in the grandparent's the one that's filing. Right. Then shouldn't it be vindicating a right that the grandparent has?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it necessarily has to. I do think, as I said earlier, that it's possible that the party seeking visitation has cognizable rights. But I think it's also possible that the child's rights are being taken into account, even if the child is not the one who initiates the action. And I would point to the fact...
So shouldn't there be a guardian ad litem here somewhere?
There is a guardian ad litem in this case, Your Honor.
And is the guardian ad litem taking a position adverse to the parents?
The guardian ad litem, Your Honor, recommended visitation and recommended
okay.
more visitation than the court ultimately awarded.
Right. So you do have a circumstance in which the children are taking a position adverse to the parents for the benefit of the grandmother.
Well, I think that's one way to see it, Your Honor, but the child does not appear in court, and the guardian ad litem considers many things, including the child's wishes. The guardian ad litem is not speaking for the child's wishes per se, though. The guardian ad litem is speaking of the child's interests. And I do think that's slightly different. And I would note that in both Nicholas L. in the Court of Appeals and in Meister in this court, the courts have continued to adjudicate these cases even when the party that was originally that petitioned for visitation is no longer part of the case. So the courts have at least implicitly acknowledged that there are other rights that are relevant here. I see my red light is on. I'm happy to answer your question if you'd like.
No, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, tell me.
Hold on. Procedural snafu.
I think Mr. LaRoy might want to say something.
That's right. We have one more. One more. That's fine.
Sure. May it please the Court, Deputy Solicitor General Kevin Leroy on behalf of Wisconsin. I'd like to start with the questions about the Wisconsin Constitution and then move into the federal substantive due process.
The microphone is not getting you, so you're going to have to move it just a little bit.
I was going to ask preceding counsel this question, but you stepped up to the plate, so I'll pitch it to you.
All right.
And that is the Cato Institute filed an amicus brief here, and your preceding counsel made reference to that brief. In that brief, they, as I recall reading it, it wasn't embracing Article 1, Section 1. It wasn't embracing the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, but rather the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Do you support that?
So this goes right back to where I'd like to start with the Wisconsin Constitution.
That's
as
why
well.
I felt comfortable.
Here is a Privileges and Immunities claim under the federal Constitution, a Article 1, Section 1 claim under the Wisconsin Constitution. The state's position is those claims have been waived. My friend cites the Wisconsin Constitution. He does not develop an argument on it. There's no historical briefing here. There's no question of the original public meaning here. So for the court to then reach out and perhaps base a holding on that, I think would be premature at this juncture. But even if there was, if Article 1, Section 1 encompassed the substantive rights that my friend is asserting, there's the next question of what level of specificity does the Constitution...
What about your friend, the Cato Institute? Do you agree with their position? That's my question. That this case should be analyzed under the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment.
No, we do not think so. We do not think that the either the Wisconsin Constitution or the federal Constitution directly controls the issue here. Specifically, we do not think that it would say that this statute, always and everywhere, infringes on the fundamental rights of parents. And the main reason why is there's a question of what level of specificity does the Constitution define the fundamental right at issue. So, of course, as Troxell recognizes, as this court recognizes, there is the general right of parents to parent their children. That is, of course, fundamental. And if you had something that was a complete infringement of that right, then perhaps you would trigger strict scrutiny. The question is, does any and every visitation order infringe that right such that strict scrutiny is triggered? And the answer to that is no. Now, perhaps on the facts here, and again, the state doesn't have a position on the specific application, perhaps that's an infringement that is remedied by this court. But you could have a visitation order that's much more narrow. You could have supervised visitation. You could have visitation of just one day a week, 1 hour a week, et cetera. So to say that the Constitution would always and everywhere prohibit even those modest visitation orders for grandparents only, I think that would be, as this court says in its cases, it's judicial activism, and it'd be legislating from the bench. And that goes...
Why do you think so? I mean, if you have... This little girl is 8 years old, and if she decides, on Tuesdays, I'm going to spend an hour with Grandma, and the court says, yes, she gets to do that, even though Mom and Dad say no, how can you say that doesn't affect the mother and dad's liberty interest? You love your child and care for your child 24/7. There are no timeouts that are allowed. I don't get your argument.
So I'd say, first, it doesn't affect the liberty interest to such the extent that it would always and everywhere trigger strict scrutiny. Now, it does affect the liberty interest to some regard, and that is why Troxell has, under the Marx rule, a holding that protects the parents' rights. And that rule is just that you have to give special weight in the best interest analysis to the parents' decision. Troxell says that is adequate protection for the parents' rights in these visitation contexts, which are narrower infringements than other types of parental rights infringements like.
So, counsel, where does the concept come from that because you are taking a smaller slice of the parent's liberty interest, that the standard is lower?
I think it would come from Troxell itself, Your Honor, where they specifically decline to apply strict scrutiny, despite the fact that Justice Thomas, in his concurrence in the judgment, presents that squarely before the court and says, normally when fundamental rights are infringed, we apply strict scrutiny. The court said, we are not going to do that in this case. And this court affirmed that very approach in Meister. And as my friend said, if Meister controls, he is not actually asking the court to overturn it. He said you could qualify it. You might have to squint at it a little bit. But he's not actually asking for overturning. And Meister is squarely on point.
So let's take something that's even narrower. Let's say that the state decides that it's really important that children eat Brussels sprouts. Could it simply pass a statute that says parents, you will feed your children Brussels sprouts twice a week.
I'm not sure if the legislature would pass such a statute, but if they did, I think you would have to go through a similar type of analysis, and you would say there is an infringement there, but it's certainly not the type of infringement like termination, which triggers strict scrutiny. And this goes back to the broader point of why substantive due process...
Hang on a second, Mary. I want to follow up on that. So if that's not subject to strict scrutiny, what if it then adopted another statute and said that on Saturday mornings it's going to be pancakes, and it started just multiplying these. But each one individually is a small slice of parental authority, and so couldn't the state subvert the parents' entire liberty interest in raising their children just by doing this a little piece at a time?
So perhaps there's a question of an additive burden over multiple state laws. I think that's a different question. Here we have Troxell, we have Meister expressly affirming the question here, and no claim that should be overruled. And the important point is this is a sensitive legislative judgment in a very difficult area of family law. Precisely.
What if the legislature decided in its wisdom that a neighbor or a teacher should have the right to petition for visitation, not based on having a parental-like relationship or an actual blood relationship like a grandparent, but what if the legislature decided to recognize the importance of those relationships in children's lives? Could it intrude on two fit parents' decision-making in that regard?
I don't think it could, Your Honor, and that's the other holding of Troxell, which we mentioned briefly in our brief, that a statute of extreme breadth that allows any person at any time to petition.
Not any person, a teacher or a neighbor.
I think that certainly the grandparent visitation statute is constitutional. I think any time you go outside of the familial relationship, you're getting into serious, serious difficulties, as Troxell itself recognized.
What's the state's position on a test that would or could be applied to rebut the presumption that the parent's decision is in the best interest of the child?
So I think the test from Troxell and from Meister is that you must give special weight to the parent's decision. So you must consider, you must give that
right.
Special
so
weight.
We're there. Okay, we've got Meister, and just say we don't overrule it. So we're at that stage. I think what counsel wants us to do, if I understand his arguments, is to put a gloss on the statute. So in addition to requiring the presumption, to require some kind of an articulation on what would be sufficient to rebut the presumption.
And so when you have special weight, that's a thumb on the scale. The grandparents now must present contrary evidence that would outweigh that. So we've taken the position that the preponderance standard satisfies. So long as you are giving that special weight, you are considering the parents' views, you are taking it very seriously. Now, Troxell doesn't take a position on whether preponderance or clear and convincing evidence is the way to go. The main thing I would like to address, I suppose, on the disputes here is this harm standard. That's nowhere to be found in the Constitution. This court, to impose it now, would be, as this court has warned again with substantive due process, to be a legislation from the bench and to usurp the power of the legislature.
How about clear and convincing? We use that in constitutional contexts all the time.
That's certainly true. The default rule is the preponderance of the evidence standard. As we said, Troxell doesn't take a position on it. They favorably cite preponderance statutes and clear and convincing statutes. Meister did the same thing. They just said the default, or it just had no rule, so we would assume the default rule. If the court is extremely concerned that clear and convincing versus preponderance would make the difference, that's it would be against the state's interest, but that's not the main beef we have here. The real problem we have here is attempting to inject the harm standard into this statute. So, again, we think preponderance would satisfy it. Another point is that if the court were to take the harm standard off the table, the lower courts would then be, again, allowed to process these sorts of claims without the confusion that the harm standard has come in. And so you might find that once you are litigating the preponderance standard with the special weight, that there's real content to this test. So I think that the court, it's sufficient for the day, is to take off the harm standard, let the courts go through under the default preponderance standard.
Counsel, I'd like to step back just a moment. You'd mentioned a distinction, I believe, in response to Justice Rebecca Bradley's question about what if the legislature enacted a statute that said a teacher or a neighbor would be able to visit. And you said that'd be different. You run into trouble once you get outside the immediate family. What is the constitutional distinction between grandparent and neighbor?
I think there's certainly a recognition that there are natural rights in the family, and that Under some readings of the Constitution directly protects those natural rights.
And what natural rights do grandparents have?
I think it would be just the general, and this is sort of going back to Justice Scalia's opinion in Troxell, just the idea that you have these familial bonds, and with those bonds come right and interest that legislatures may appropriately find worthy of protection. And that's
right.
Exactly.
But I think he was referring to the parents and the children, yeah?
I think he's certainly primarily, if I may answer.
Yeah, you can answer that question then.
I think he's certainly primarily referring to the parents of the children, but grandparents are also a worthy recipient of the protection of the legislative judgment, and that is exactly what we have here, and that's what the court affirmed in Meister. Thank you very much.
Now I think we are ready for rebuttal.
So much to say, I couldn't wait to get back up here.
Well, it's a very interesting case, no question.
I just want to speak very briefly about the Roger D.H. presumption. And I actually like to say quote-unquote presumption. You know, the argument we made in our brief was a very simple one. It's that with or without the presumption, the grandparent, in order to prevail, has to put forth evidence that convinces the circuit court by a preponderance of the evidence that the visitation sought is in the child's best interest. There's no difference. The two standards are the same. It doesn't provide any special weight. It's just a restatement, and a clunky one, frankly, of the best interest of the child standard. And we know for certain that that standard is unconstitutional, because 6 of the 9 justices in Troxell agreed on that point.
Can you talk, counsel, just briefly about these other states that you mentioned in your brief that did impose or superimpose the harm piece of it in trying to make the statute constitutional? Were those situations where their statutes look similar? Those of Wisconsin, I did not look at each and every one of them.
There is no uniform grandparent visitation statute out there, or if there is, it appears no states have adopted it. So all these statutes do have subtle differences. Now, I think there's a spectrum from very permissive to not very permissive at all. I think if you did a 50-state analysis, you would see that Wisconsin is very close to the end of the spectrum of being quite permissive. And the reason that we included some extended quotes from those cases is that I think the reasoning of those courts is persuasive, because they typically begin with the question of, does strict scrutiny apply? And I think it's very hard to argue that it doesn't, because how do these orders, like the one issued in this case, how can you say they don't significantly impact fit parents' fundamental liberty interest in raising their children as they deem fit? I think they necessarily do. And once you take that step, the analysis flows quite easily to the only standard that's constitutional is the harm standard.
Well, there's no case that we have used where we've imposed harm as a constitutional standard.
That is true, although this court has, when discussing statutes that implicate the interests we're talking about in this case, has made the point of saying that the compelling interest is preventing harm to the child. So it hasn't applied the standard in the way we're asking it to, but it has recognized that that is a compelling state interest.
Counsel, why isn't just upping the burden sufficient for you? Why do we have to also write in, if you will, harm as a point of consideration to save the constitutionality in this as-applied challenge?
I think I can tie that into Justice Kelly's Brussels sprout hypothetical.
I can hardly wait.
Yeah, right. Me either.
Because what you're saying, the clear and convincing evidence standard certainly gets you closer to constitutionality. But you're still saying, if strict scrutiny applies, that the state's compelling interest is protecting the best interests of the child. And I think that's a dangerous path to go down, because there's lots of decisions that fit parents make that most of us might say aren't necessarily in the best interests of the child, whether it's not giving them vegetables, smoking in front of them, letting them play violent video games. The legislature can't empower circuit courts to get in and second-guess those decisions when the parents are fit. Or if the legislature can do that, then I think the liberty interest is nothing but a sham. And that's what Justice Souter points out in his concurrence in Troxell, that second-guessing this decision that fit parents make isn't fundamentally different than second-guessing other decisions that fit parents make. And for better or worse, sometimes the majority of us, and maybe the legislature, are going to disagree with some of those decisions. But constitutionally, those are left to the parents. That's the entire point of the liberty interest, to prevent meddling in those decisions, even if a circuit court judge thinks a better decision could be made. The one final thing I'll note briefly, and it was noted in the briefs in passing, was this court's decision in 1995 in Holtzman, which found a common law right. I see my time is up.
You can finish your answer.
It found a common law right to petition for visitation, but only if the petitioner could show a parent-like relationship with the child and could show a significant triggering event. Now, I don't think that's exactly equivalent to the harm standard, but the reason those high burdens were imposed was in part because even back then, before Troxell, this court recognized the fundamental liberty interest at stake. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you all very much. This was a very interesting case, and thanks to all the amicus, one of whom argued today before us, for their input, because it's not an easy case, and there are a lot of interests that we will look at and carefully consider. We are going to take a break now and leave for a bit so one class of students can leave us and another can come in. And so we are adjourned until our second case. And we missed the fire alarm. Look at that. It'll still be so if you're here.